Welcome to another edition of The Realist Report. This is your host, John Friend. Today is Tuesday, September 20th, 2022. Of course, my website is therealistreport.com, where you will find an extensive archive of these podcasts, as well as other programs I participate in. You will also find all of my blog posts and articles, my Twitter feed, which is embedded in the right-hand sidebar of the website, and many other useful and important links. I am on Twitter and Gab at Realist Report, and you can find me on Telegram at t.me/TheRealistReport. I am also a regular reporter for American Free Press, America's last real newspaper, and I also contribute to the Barnes Review. Please do subscribe to these fine print publications if you do not already. Check out AmericanFreePress.net and BarnesReview.org for all the details. All right, tonight I am joined by Tim Kelly, a returning guest. Tim is one of the most knowledgeable and insightful commentators in the alternative media, and he hosts a podcast called Our Interesting Times and Powers and Principalities. All right, Tim Kelly, welcome back to the program, sir. How are you this evening?
Very well. How are you doing?
I'm doing just fine. Thank you very much for taking the time to join me once again. I'm sure most listeners are familiar with your work by now, but if not, just a reminder, you do host one of the best podcasts in the alternative independent media, and it's called Our Interesting Times. And you, in that program, you kind of interview special guests mostly, and then you also host a weekly program with Joseph Atwill called Powers and Principalities that usually comes out either Saturday or Sunday, I believe. And I'll have a link over to your, I think it's Podomatic, right, is where you post
yes.
All your – yeah, Podomatic. And I follow your site – or your podcast, I should say, mostly through just the RSS feed. So
okay.
I just have everything downloaded right to my phone. That's an easy way to follow podcast programs. So and like I said, yours is one of the best. You always have great guests. Yeah, great guests. And then you and Joseph Atwill always have great conversations on the weekends. So I would encourage people to check out your show if they are not already. And before we jump into some of the main topics I had, you recently interviewed Dr. Kevin Barrett, who is a regular contributor to American Free Press, America's mm-hmm. last real newspaper, a newspaper I've been writing for since 2013. And you guys discussed 9/11 pretty extensively. I also had Dr. Barrett on recently on my program to discuss the 21st anniversary of 9/11. And I wanted to ask you quick, how important of an event is 9/11 at this point, 21 years later? I mean, do you still think it's a relevant, like 9/11 truth in general, do you still think it's something relevant and that should be addressed by the alternative media?
Yeah, I think it's as relevant as the John F. Kennedy assassination, the Pearl Harbor raid, and, you know, the Balfour Declaration. These are historical events or occurrences that have never been gotten the proper treatment in standard historical accounts or the media. And so they're still not really widely, although there's a lot of consciousness regarding these events, particularly the JFK assassination, even 9/11, the official narrative is still out there promoted. And so it's not given the proper treatment, of course, because the regime controls the media. So you're never going to get a full accounting of the guilty parties, what really went down. There's still a lot of debate about these events. And yes, years go by, there's different, as these things sort of get unwrapped or the layers are turned off, there's different aspects to it. You know, like the Kennedy assassination and more recent research has revealed things like the, a lot of evidence of the role of the Israelis, not just sort of vague deep state CIA connections. Same with the 9/11. That was the subject of my discussion with Kevin Barrett, the triangulation theory that's been posited by various researchers regarding the Israeli connection to that event and sort of how it was multifaceted or layered. The attack on the Pentagon, perhaps something, and indeed an inside job, you know, because the accountants were killed at the Pentagon. Whereas the events up in New York might have been a separate event. That's the theory regarding involving the Israelis.
Yeah, that's pretty interesting. And wasn't it the – who was it? Rabbi Dov Zakheim? He was like this Jewish rabbi that was responsible for like overseeing the budget of the Pentagon essentially.
Yeah, that links the Pentagon event to maybe the events up in New York and in Pennsylvania. The he was the Comptroller General, and of course the Pentagon trillions of dollars had gone missing, and of course I suspect a lot of it ended up in Tel Aviv at some point.
Oh yeah.
And sort of a lot of the Office of Special Plans. That was obviously they run for the Iraq War, but these neocons that have sort of had themselves installed in various offices of the U.S. government, national security state. Of course, you have the Project for New American Century. These people would go on to staff the Bush administration that came into power in January 2001. And you have a lot of overlap here. This is the problem when you have, about Zionists in positions of the U.S. government, because their loyalty at least should be questioned. But any rational person will look at and question their loyalty and their involvement in some of these events. I think it was the Army Intelligence Report had come out that summer talking about the role of the ability of Israeli and its intelligence apparatus, the Mossad, to pull off a false flag event. So they were remarkably...
I think they referred to the Mossad as a wild card that could stage terrorist attacks and blame their enemies in order to kickstart wars.
Yeah, which is
Yeah, they have a long history of doing that. Yeah, well, that's interesting, and that was a good podcast. Dr. Barrett is really one of the – I mean, he's always been like a leader in the 9/11 truth movement, and he has a very serious scholarly background, which is very good. I've learned a lot from him over the years. I don't always agree with everything, but – at the same time, I think he has a lot of important things to say about 9/11. And one of the things that we discussed was sort of this consensus that's been developed over the course of the past 21 years, really researching 9/11 and pursuing 9/11 truth. And it seems like more or less everybody's basically on the same page. There's a lot of different aspects of 9/11 that people wouldn't agree on. But overall, the idea that it was essentially a Mossad operation, Israel played a key role, these Jewish neocons in the U.S. government, in controlling the mass media, played the leading role, and it certainly benefited this overall Zionist agenda, and it kickstarted this Zionist first foreign policy in the Middle East, right? So, I mean, that's all very well established, and basically everybody is more or less in agreement with that basic idea, which is a very, very positive development in my mind. Because when I first got into 9/11, it was like, everybody was debating about every little aspect. You couldn't talk about Israel. You couldn't talk about Jews because that was, anti-Semitic and hateful and all this other stuff. But, we've really come a long way. And the evidence is just simply overwhelming. I mean, it's no secret. It's right there in black and white for anybody to see. I mean, we even have police reports of the only people arrested in New York connected to what was going on. And they were, of course, Israeli Mossad. And, basically, they were like intelligence and military operatives of Israel.
And yeah, the movie.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So this is all very
vans
well.
Vans being pulled over. You have the explosives in them. And of course the the dancing Israelis, which, became the dancing Middle Easterners.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So anyways, this is all very well established at this point. And one last question, I guess, because 9/11 truth was really like my big, sort of red pill, I guess you could, sort of say it led me down all these other paths of research and considering many other aspects of history and race and the way the media works and just the way our society in general works, I guess. How important was 9/11 truth in your sort of like red pilling process?
Well, for me personally, it was a kind of a gradual approach as I sort of became aware or availed myself of the information. My opinion of it changed, as it should, I guess. It was a very gradual, because I came of age in the 80s and 90s and the end of the Cold War. And I saw something in the 90s that I found very disturbing regarding U.S. foreign policy, which we're now seeing today, like with the geopolitics and the sort of the war in the Ukraine that the U.S. provoked. Whereas the Soviet Union dissolved, Warsaw Pact disintegrated, but NATO didn't. And immediately there were excuses for wars, whether that's Saddam Hussein's invasion of Kuwait in 1990, which we now know is provoked or at least encouraged by U.S. Diplomacy. We had the wars in the Balkans. Yugoslavia was sort of taken apart by the United States and NATO. then the ensuing civil war is used as a pretext to intervene. And that, and all of a sudden you had sort of Muslims in the mid 90s started becoming bad guys again. And this was the, it was weird because, you know, in the 80s, Muslims were good because they were fighting the big bad Soviets, the Mujahideen. And in fact, they were lionized in, I think, the third Rambo film, which came out just when the Soviets were withdrawing from Afghanistan, I think in 89, I think, around that. But then all of a sudden they became big mad Muslims again. And then, of course, you had the emergence of Osama bin Laden as a sort of among these villains, and then 9/11, of course. But immediately, I guess immediately in the aftermath of 9/11, I was just saying, well, this is a blowback for U.S. foreign policy. I knew something was immediately wrong with the reaction, like when Afghanistan became a long-term occupation as opposed to a sort of a punitive attack for an act of war. Then I kind of found out that, you know, that was kind of a the Taliban were kind of falsely accused of having active involvement in the attacks. Then, of course, the attacks themselves were very problematic as you looked into the evidence. Most people aren't aware that Osama bin Laden was never charged with being involved in 9/11 attacks, and he did deny taking part in them. On, I think late September, he denied, saying this is not something we would do, we wouldn't target civilians. So, and they were never provided evidence to that.
I think he actually even specifically mentioned that the only people capable of doing something like this would be Israel or like the CIA.
Yes.
You know, he pretty much identified the main people responsible for 9/11 right off the bat. Yeah. And then from what I understand, I mean, he died shortly thereafter, which was reported even by mainstream news at the time.
Yes.
But it's sort of been sort of, you know, one of these memory hold topics, you know, nobody knows about anymore, but it was reported on at the time. So anyways, yeah, it's an interesting topic. I was just curious. I wanted to start off by asking that, considering 9/11 was just, what, 10, 11 days ago. So that's interesting. And again, that conversation was great. I know you've covered 9/11 on other programs as well, and it's a topic that I've covered repeatedly since I've been doing podcasting and you know, writing on the website and you know, writing for American Free Press. It's a topic that is near and dear to my heart, so I just wanted to ask you briefly.
Yeah. It's still relevant because the Biden administration now is equating so-called election deniers, people who think something's fishy with the 2020 election and who have the audacity to protest. She's equating them to the terrorist that allegedly attacked the United States on September 11th, 2001. And she wants them to be treated as such, which would be, what, like drone attacks? You know,
indefinite detention, torture. Yeah.
To list.
Yeah.
Now, so then you have this equation of January 6th, to Pearl Harbor or to the Civil War or to 9/11. And you also have Biden saying that this sort of vague or white supremacist threat. There's no organization, I think, which actually claims to be white supremacist. That's a term they've reintroduced into the lexicon, not something I've heard of in a long time. How they presented clear and present danger to the peace and tranquility of the homeland. As by the way, that's another term that came up after 9/11. Homeland. That was never in public lexicon till after 9/11. Department of Homeland Security is these. I thought that's what the Pentagon was for, or whatever. Various police departments and FBI, but nevertheless, they created another alphabet soup agency that absorbed $50 billion a year. The idea that, again, clear and present danger is that type of language has been used to justify all types of restrictions on, you know, free speech, the First Amendment, free speech, and also civil liberties in general, particularly during, with the U.S. entry into the First World War, justifying the Wilson administration's, restrictions on civil liberties to stifle opposition to America's entry into that war, which was rather robust until it was suppressed, by the federal government,
Right. Oh, yeah, absolutely. There's a long history of it. And you're right. I mean, the narrative of, these evil Islamic extremists, that threaten American democracy has sort of morphed into now it's, quote unquote, domestic white supremacists and, mm-hmm. Domestic extremists. A topic we'll get into. I do want to address President Biden's relatively recent speech in Philadelphia. It was just a couple weeks ago, and get your take on that. Before we do that, I definitely want to start off by discussing a topic that you've been covering from day one, and you've done a great job covering the COVID quote unquote pandemic or plandemic, as some refer to it as. Actually, kind of a funny anecdote. I was at a sort of like a family reunion neighborhood gathering over this past weekend. And this lady that I grew up with, she used to babysit my sister and I, and she just casually, we were talking about the pandemic and the vaccines and stuff, and she just casually dropped that it was a plandemic in the, it didn't even sort of just use the word plandemic like it was normal. And I was like, oh wow, you actually get it. And she's like, yes, I do. You too? So it was it was pretty funny. We were sitting there with a group of 20 people, and she's just casually using the word plandemic, and it was and this is somebody I haven't seen for a very, very long time, so I thought that was cool. And there's more and more people that are getting it, sort of waking up to this, which is so obvious at this point. But anyways, I do want to talk about this topic because President Biden was just recently, this past weekend, he was interviewed, or maybe they aired it. I know they aired the interview this weekend on 60 Minutes on Sunday night. And he actually declared that the pandemic is over. And he's drawn a lot of heat from this. I'm actually looking at an article published by TheHill.com. Headline is, Biden draws heat for saying pandemic is over. And it says here, President Biden is drawing criticism from lawmakers and public health experts who warn his assertion that the COVID-19 pandemic is over could undermine the administration's rollout of new booster shots, as well as efforts to secure more funding from Congress. Quote, the pandemic is over, Biden told 60 Minutes in an interview that ran on Sunday. We still have a problem with COVID. We're still doing a lot of work on it. And this is just Biden speaking, but basically saying the pandemic is over. If you notice, no one's wearing masks. Everybody seems to be in pretty good shape. And so I think it's changing, etc. So interesting comments. And this is another one of these comments that Biden makes where he basically, sort of throws a wrench in his administration's policy, whether it's, COVID in this case, or he also said in that interview that the U.S. would militarily defend Taiwan, which this is something that he said, in the past as well. Mm-hmm. But something that sort of totally runs contrary to longstanding U.S. policy towards China, the whole one China policy. But anyways, I'm curious, what did you make of this statement by Biden? Is the pandemic truly over? I mean, you look at public opinion polling and talk to, most average people, and people are just plain sick and tired of this alleged pandemic and have essentially moved on with their lives. At least, majority of people, I think you could say at this point.
Yeah, some are, I think, are so psychologically damaged, they'll never recover.
Mask forever. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Whatever mask, again. It's kind of funny because people are perturbed by it by the president's statement. What they're saying is that we have policies, we don't want reality to impact them because there's a lot of money at stake, booster shots, programs. Emergency powers. I think there are dozens of we've been under emergency decree or governance for past 21 years, and we just become inured to it. But basically, what is this? A blank check for government, an excuse to do things. And so if you give a government emergency powers, lo and behold, don't be surprised that you find yourself always in emergencies. And the pandemic or the plandemic is a perfect example of a sort of a confected emergency, because it's all a question of how you interpret the data. And with the PCR test, which were never supposed to be used as a diagnostic tool, yet it was. Most people who've looked and are familiar with the problems with the PCR test, because you just have to, if you run it so many cycles, you get positive tests. You run less cycles, I think below 30, you'll get a lot of negative tests, which of course how you want to run the test. And of course the whole problem with the pandemic was it was based on this theory of asymptomatic spreading, which is ridiculous. Never before have people worried about asymptomatic spreading. It's just not, from a standpoint of public health, just standpoint of practical public policy, you can't worry about it because society will collapse if you're constantly worried, which has we've kind of seen in a way because of the effects, the economy. We've had high inflation because they printed up hundreds of billions of dollars to pay people not to work, to bail things out. And that's how you got the pandemic. You paid people to panic. If you pay people to panic, they're going to panic. You reward people with it. And that's all part of the CARES Act. And a lot of money was at stake. There was earlier on during the pandemic, there was there were people in Maine, because Maine never had many cases at all. And I think this was the spring of 2021. The governor was shutting down a lot of businesses, the tourist industry. And so there's a lot of opposition to it. And I think the Republican minority coalition and legislature asked for a special legislature working with the Democrats to repeal the emergency decree to deny the governor out there. She's one of these crazy governors. And they said, we want to do that because that will jeopardize emergency funding.
Yeah, that's
not that people were sick. They want the funding, you know, so exactly. That's how you got people to go along with it. You bribe people to go along with it. You know?
Well, right. And we saw how financially incentivized the whole entire medical system was with this fake pandemic, whether it was the hospitals getting I don't even know the exact figures. I mean, I've seen estimates from $20,000 to $40,000 or $50,000, mm-hmm, for each, you know, COVID diagnosis, or, you know, putting somebody on a ventilator, you get money, you know, all these sorts of things. So it was basically financially incentivized. These hospitals and doctors and large corporations were financially incentivized to go along and run with this COVID hoax. And, you know, I was thinking about it. I mean, we were talking about 9/11, and I would argue, I have argued for a very long time that 9/11 was like the biggest, you know, false flag psychological operation in modern history. But I think COVID actually surpasses even 9/11. I mean, COVID was really the biggest game-changing event in the past 20 years, for sure, and it totally transformed the world. And I don't, I mean, he's saying that the pandemic is quote unquote over, but I don't think it's going anywhere. I think a lot of these policies are going to continue to be around. That that precedent that it set, that the government could just simply declare an emergency, declare a pandemic, and shut down society, which is, to me, from what I've read, is actually even a bigger reason why we have such an economic crisis and why inflation is rising, is we shut down the economy. And yeah, this totally disrupted the supply chains, which has just, you know, sort of had a trickle-down effect on prices and everything else. And it's totally screwed everything up, and it's going to take a long time to snap out of this, if we ever even can at this point. And frankly, I think that might have been part of the agenda to begin with.
Yeah, economic destruction. That's what here talk discussions about the Great Reset. And I think what happened in the West is they leverage debt as far as they can. So they need some sort of reset. And you do that with a war, a Great Depression or something. And so some people have traced it back to the meeting in Jackson Hole, Wyoming, in August 2019. And I think it was BlackRock, representatives from BlackRock submitted the Going Direct plan. And that would be that the central banks would more or less take over the fiscal policies of sovereign governments. Basically, sovereign governments would become not as if they weren't already, but enslaved to debt to the central banks, which were privately owned. No one really has a right to know who owns them or operates them. It's, you know, out of the Bank of International Settlements. And you have this very occulted financial system that's linked into Davos and the very people that, you know, like the World Economic Forum, World Health Organization, and Event 201, and the pandemic, people that game, kind of war game the event in the fall, just a few months before the pandemic was announced. But basically, the idea was that the repo market was freezing up, and so they need threatened a sort of a deflationary crack up, and the only way to avoid that is you have to inject liquidity into the economy. Of course, after the bailouts of 2008-2009, this might cause an inflationary spiral or a sort of a run on the dollar. So what do you do? Well, you have an emergency, and that's one of the functions of the pandemic. It's one agenda. These things have multiple agendas, of course, behind it. One is also technocratic. We see that with Bill Gates and the World Economic Forum and all that. But, you know, you have Larry Fink's BlackRock. They submit a plan, and lo and behold, in March, when the pandemic, you know, when the economy is shut down, their plan for going direct is implemented with the bailout of the stock market. And BlackRock is put in charge of revitalizing the U.S. economy. So they're given literally hundreds of trillions of dollars to play with. And yep, this brought in this huge transfer of wealth. It was not just the capitalization of BlackRock with, you know, with funding money from the Fed, but also the closing down of small businesses and these things. So these large corporations were to pick up the slack. And this gets us towards that more of a towards technocracy and corporatist control, because the big corporations, all part of this ESG scam or scheme that's spearheaded by Larry Fink's BlackRock to sort of decarbonize, change the economy, You know, it's all about resource control. It's a resource grab, and they need an emergency. And this goes back to decades of planning to the Club of Rome and, you know, the Rockefellers and their idea of controlling the economy. And it all stems with I think 1971 when the U.S. cut off the last ties to the gold standard, and you had a fiat currency, and a fiat currency eventually will be a dead currency, so the end of money. And that's why you see a lot of this Klaus Schwab stuff with more or less a great, you know, with digital money, central bank digital currencies. These aren't really currencies; these are store credits in the company store. And their vision is the globe is one big company store, and we're just serfs who will own nothing and love it, as predicted by the World Economic Forum.
Yeah. Absolutely. Well, you're right. I mean, I agree with everything you just said. There's so many agendas that have been advanced with this COVID-19 pandemic, the technocratic agenda, the financial agenda. I'm looking at an article here from Time Magazine, and this was published, I think, in September of 2020. The top 1% of Americans have taken $50 trillion from the bottom 90%. And this is all during the pandemic. I mean, there have been – even mainstream sources are like basically having to admit this, that mm-hmm. COVID was a massive wealth transfer. And this was facilitated by the CARES Act, I believe it was, where, you know, BlackRock essentially took over the balance sheet of the Federal Reserve. Is that right? Mm-hmm. Is that basically what happened? And of course – and, you know, they have investments and basically ownership stakes in almost all major companies, from what I understand, and you know, retirement funds, pension funds, big investment banks. So they essentially control large aspects of the overall U.S. economy. And this is a company run by a man named Larry Fink, a Jewish individual, of mm-hmm. course, we should point out. and this is a guy that's up there getting interviewed by mainstream news, by I think it was Forbes magazine recently, where he was basically blaming inflation on people not wanting to go back to work and, you know, the working class not, you know, not spending enough money and this sort of thing. Of course, blaming everybody but himself and the other criminals mm-hmm. around him that have, you know, basically wrecked our economy and stolen all the money. And that's basically where we're at today. And Biden's comments, the biggest thing that, you know, the biggest pushback that he's receiving is one that it, you know, lessens the image that there's like this emergency, right, that the government needs to control and, you know, take charge of and implement all these policies to keep us safe and all this other nonsense. And also the financial aspect. How are they going to continue to justify billions of dollars in purchasing vaccines and, you know, giving money to all these hospitals and the healthcare and the pharmaceutical industry in general if they're, you know, if the pandemic is over, as he said?
Yeah,
it's one big scam, basically.
At the same time, the NATO, the United States, they've fomented or, you know, provoked this war in Eurasia, in Ukraine, which again, which further exasperates the economies, particularly Germany. Germany is appears to be cutting its own throat, but I don't think Germany is sovereign. Germany has been conquered since 1945, has been independent since 1945, and you have the government there dedicated to more or less imposing a Morgenthau Plan 2.0 on Germany. And there was a recent RAND report release regarding this plan. They're saying this is a scheme or a plan by the United States. And what I mean by United States is it's the Anglo-American Zio Empire to destroy the economies of Europe because they see it as competing for resources. And also Germany – that is trading with China and Germany is independent. And so how do you maintain control of the world? You can't. So this goes back to the Mackinder Doctrine, sort of this doctrine which culminated in the 30 Years' War of the 20th century, which would be the First and Second World War, to destroy German power, because Germany has always been a problem from the standpoint of the Leviathan, which would be the British Empire, which is really Rothschild banking interest. You know, and that, you know, this is something, you know, it's a front for all these financial powers, and they can't, same thing in the United States when finance took over from agriculture and industry and became increasingly Jewish, it became increasingly malevolent and destructive and also unsustainable because it's based on compound interest and usury, which ultimately collapses on itself.
Right. You know, and we're seeing that today. Yeah, absolutely. And they seem to use these entirely manufactured crises or crises that they themselves create through their own policies, like the 2008 financial crisis or this alleged COVID-19 pandemic, to maintain and perpetuate their totally corrupt, illegitimate system, right? I mean, that seems to be the main factor in a lot of these alleged crises. You know, it's just to maintain the system. And we see that with this war in Ukraine. You know, we're throwing every single dollar we have at Ukraine in order to prevent Russia from even being able to challenge this, frankly, Jewish-led world order. I mean, the Jews basically control the United States, and it's like this America-centric world order at this point. And that, to me, is really the bigger picture of what's going on with that whole conflict.
Yeah, it's so the Jewish animus towards Russia, which is almost ancestral in a way, because it dates back to the Pale of the Settlement, and there are tales of woes they suffered at the hands of the czars. And then when a few wealthy Jews in the United States had enough wherewithal, they started trying to undermine the czarist regime in Russia with Jacob Schiff. And of course, they fund the Bolsheviks, you know, and the Czechists, which were largely Jewish. The rest, as I say, is history. What's crazy now is, you said, the Ukraine. Anyone looking at a map and just familiar with, you know, what was going on would have to say, well, why not give Russia a security guarantee? Why expand NATO? You know,
exactly.
NATO's absorbed almost every former Warsaw Pact nation. And then some. And so that's, you know, how can you look at it and go, look at a map and go, is that a bit provocative? Well, then they say, well, Putin's Hitler or something, you know.
And yeah, it's absurd.
Yeah. Why do that? It's particularly at a time when the global economy is so fragile and has been so disrupted by all the COVID nonsense that they start a war, you know, which then further puts a stranglehold on international trade, energy supply routes. Nord Stream 2 is cut off. Now they're talking about cutting off Nord Stream 1, you know, because they don't want Germany buying natural gas from Russia because it's cheap, relatively cheap. And again, it establishes some independence of Germany from the Anglo-American Zio Empire and threatens to build a sort of a central Eurasian condominium, which again goes back to the Mackinder Doctrine. You can't control the world and allow, you know, this trading bloc to develop, you know.
Right, exactly.
But it's kind of their own makings. I don't know if it's planning or they just, you know, they create their own problems, because China itself is a creation of the trilateralist and Kissinger and these things in the 70s. And also, you know, the development that occurred in China since the 1990s, which, from what I understand, some people suspect the funding for that was some of the trillions went missing from the Pentagon. So,
oh, wow. That wouldn't surprise me.
China, yeah.
Well, you know, China is an interesting case. I mean, I've never been to China. I have not studied Chinese history or politics in any great detail. But, you know, from what I see, from what I hear from some of their leaders – they seem to be much more respectable than the clowns that we have running in the United States. And I would say the same thing about Russia. You know, I listen to a guy like Putin or any of his spokespeople, and these are people that appear to have common sense. They have some intelligence. They seem to have some respectability. They seem to genuinely care about their country, and they're not just, you know, total globalist scumbags like we have in the West. But at the same time, I'm looking at, like, going back to COVID, China continues to implement these lockdowns. They have this zero COVID policy. I don't know if you've been following any recent developments in China, but I mean, every other week they're locking down a new city and people are, you know, starving. And there's even, you know, for how docile, you know, most Chinese people are, it seems like, anyways. I've never been there. I don't know, you know, firsthand, but that's sort of the idea. That's what a lot of people say. And even the Chinese are getting sick and tired of this, and they're rising up and they're protesting and they're saying enough is enough. You know, with this whole zero COVID policy. So it's like they seem to be, in a certain sense, standing up to this globalist world order, but at the same time going along with the key agenda of it, which is this COVID lockdown and this COVID agenda. So I'm not sure what to make of it. It's pretty confusing, frankly, to me.
Well, it wouldn't be the first time that an Asian power was industrialized and then becoming an enemy, like Japan in the early part of the 20th century, late 19th and early 20th century, when Japan was sort of the cat's paw of Anglo-American policy in Asia. Then Japan got too big for its britches and had to be put back in its place. That's why you had the Pacific War. Because you know they wanted their own greater East Asia co-prosperity sphere, sort of a Monroe Doctrine, Asian for the Asians, and they were deleted. And of course, given the threat of Bolshevism, they could have been used as a bulwark against Bolshevism, which they were, by the way. But then other interests prevailed, and U.S. provoked war against Japan, you know, with embargoes and things like that. And you had the Pearl Harbor raid, and that was sort of FDR's backdoor to war into the war in Europe, because that got Germany to declare war against the United States a few days after the Pearl Harbor raid, because of the America had been at war with Germany, you know, covertly since 1940, early 41, in the Battle of the Atlantic, and also with the Atlantic Charter and Lend-Lease and these things. You just sort of prelude America's full entry into the war. But China again was developed, and now maybe China has its own plans. Now, it doesn't mean some people have speculated even the COVID operation, they were on board with it. Some people claim it was leaked from a lab, and now whether or not something was leaked, and that doesn't necessarily mean that what was leaked caused the pandemic or was the source of all the respiratory illnesses throughout the world, because respiratory illnesses have always existed. And from what I understand, all the symptoms that are attributed to COVID have long existed. So again, it's just a question of ascribing these symptoms to COVID and creating the pandemic. And of course, the fact that the death rate, I think the average death rate was 81 throughout the whole, globally, I think. Throughout the whole world. And strange enough, Africa didn't have it. You know,
yeah.
For all the health problems Africa has, they didn't have COVID. But the idea is that perhaps China, and this is some people speculated, is that their interest in provoking the COVID pandemic was getting Western nations to destroy their economies. So sort of 3D chess by the part of Beijing.
You know. Interesting, but then why would they be going along with it, or why would they be doing it to their own population?
Because I wouldn't say it's uniquely Chinese to willing to kill your own people. Unfortunately, governments throughout the world are willing to do that. But they figure their economy is large enough, their society is large enough, they can shut down huge sections of it for a form of a theater.
That's interesting. I've never really heard it put that way. That's an interesting idea. Yeah. Well, I was following some developments with it. I actually put together a brief little article for American Free Press in the last issue, and it does appear. I mean, these policies, like these lockdown policies, as it is anywhere, anytime any country implements any of these lockdown policies, where you know there's restrictions put on you know people leaving their house and you know conducting business. And even having businesses open, I mean, it's going to have very serious economic impacts over time. And it does appear to be, you know, severely impacting the Chinese economy. And the Chinese economy is, you know, one of the major players in the global economy, obviously. So it's going to have a trickle-down effect. So I don't know. It's pretty baffling if you ask me. But it seems like in America, like to a certain extent, the pandemic hysteria we do see sort of dying down. I mean, of course, government figures are still out there saying, go get your vaccine and get your flu vaccine, get your COVID vaccine. In fact, the one guy in the Biden administration, he's an Indian guy. I can't remember his name off the top of my head, but he was out there saying, you know, God gave us two arms, one for the COVID jab and one for the flu jab. And I'm just sitting there like, how is this good PR? Science. Like, yeah, like who is coming up with this stuff? Like,
Governor Hochul, the unelected governor of New York, claimed that Jesus gave us
the vaccine. Yeah, I know. These people are just ridiculous. But that being said, I mean, you do see a lot of the restrictions sort of being rolled back. I don't really see face masks anymore. I mean, you still do see certain people wearing them, but, you know, no businesses are really asking you to put them on. In fact, even another story I saw over at Technocracy News, Patrick Wood's website, who has also covered the fake pandemic very, very well from the very, very beginning, identifying the key players behind it all. He pointed out that a lot of large corporations and even government agencies and school districts and whatnot are very, very quietly rolling back their vaccine mandates. And, you know, so it's just it's so infuriating seeing that, because all anyone had to do was just stand their ground and refuse to take the vaccine.
Yeah, nobody, hopefully that would be the lesson taken away from this.
Yeah, I mean, these were these alleged mandates were on very, very dubious legal grounds to begin with, and that's putting it mildly.
It was such a
they were not legal at all.
It was such
it was.
That happened. It was this time last year, and there were a full court press for it, and it was just. They had no authority in the law, and it was just pressure. And I remember at the time thinking, just don't back down. Within a few months, it'll collapse, and it did.
Yep, exactly. Well, you know what it was? Like this whole operation, essentially, and like 9/11 and many other of these sort of game-changing events that we see throughout history, it is basically a fear-based mind control program. It's all based on fear. It's all designed to attack you. To attack the public, the masses on a very deep psychological level, and create fear and create trauma, and, you know, basically get them to do whatever the authorities are telling them to do. And that was with this situation, to take the vaccine.
Well, yeah, because that's how sort of the news cycle and handles it now, because they you need constant crisis or problems just to fill the time. And so you have that. But yeah, if it's not that, it's monkeypox, you know, it's Ebola or something. And again, I'm old enough to remember when these things just didn't occur. You didn't have these, you know, when I was younger, society was very modern and there was international travel and mobility. You didn't have these weekly health crises. So when you start having these weekly health crises, it's obvious it's an operation. It's not based in any reality. And what happened was the regime, the government, is going to need some sort of pretext for an emergency. And so when you have something like the Cold War, which is a long, drawn-out, multi-decade-long affair, you have that. And you had, you know, the scare techniques, the civil defense ads about, you know, duck and cover with nuclear war and these things.
Yeah, the very
with a turtle or something. And that was all – that was, what's his name? Bernays doing that. And he goes way back to the Creel Committee in the First World War. And same with, you know, Walter Lippmann and, you know, these characters who have nothing but contempt for the common man. And of course, some of their observations are actually depressingly true. It's just a reality is that you really can't have democracy or populist rule, that you're always going to have some sort of elite or oligarchy controlling things. The question is that elite going to be malevolent?
Right. Yeah. No, that's so
just
true.
Right, the moment you have organization and bureaucracy, you have oligarchy because you have people running things. But if you can disperse power, you can create checks and balances, perhaps, or some sort of system, you know, or just have a sovereign. Theoretically, a monarch could provide this, sort of an adult in the room that could say, okay, you're not going to do this. I'm gonna end this, and that's the function that a sovereign serves. But when you talk about sovereignties, we are talking about all the stuff with COVID and all these non-governmental organizations that are ties to the like the Gates Foundation, Gavi, the World Health Organization, and how they create a sort of these satellite of colleges and health departments that spew the same propaganda. These corporations, something like BlackRock or Vanguard, which control trillions in assets, which now are more powerful than sovereign governments, is. Who is the sovereign in these things? I mean, to what extent do elections matter if they can, you know, pick and choose who's elected, or they can set up systems? And you saw that with the Time article, Molly Ball's article about Time, how you had this unofficial, you know, conspiracy, if you will, whether that makes a difference or not, working with, with businesses and the media and big tech to control the election.
No, not to control the election, to actually fortify and secure democracy.
Yeah, which
that's
means,
that's the way she framed it, anyways. Yeah,
but fortifying by meaning getting a getting the result you want.
Yeah, exactly. Basically, steal the election. Yeah,
and that's done by it's done by manipulation of the so-called free press, which are owned by a handful of corporations, and they're there to control the flow of information. And they do that, you saw it with Facebook and with Twitter controlling the Hunter Biden story, the laptop story, or just controlling, the content, the curating information or news on social media, which is, you know, largely created by the taxpayers. I'm sorry, Google and Facebook were all capitalized by the CIA. Sorry, and the taxpayers pay for that. And so these companies are largely utility companies. They're not really private companies. They weren't capitalized with private funds. There is some public claim to them. And this is the public forum, if you will. And so if you restrict speech on those forums or fora, you destroy free speech, which they've done. And now with this, I think Alex Berenson and some other lawsuits that expose that the federal government is directly involved with these big tech companies in suppressing free speech, which creates a lot of liability, not only for the government, for the said corporations, because if they're involved in a conspiracy to suppress free speech, that's illegal, it's unconstitutional, and they should be, if the court system works properly, they should be subject to severe penalties that I would like to see results in their bankruptcy and dissolution or breakup. You know,
that's right. Absolutely.
They're involved because that's a serious, talk about a crime against democracy. Or I like to say it's a crime against the republic, against the Constitution and freedom of speech and free elections. Because you can't have a free election. You can't have this democracy where supposedly the people are given the information from the free press to forth the state to make the best decision and who they want to vote for, who they don't want to vote for, but then have all the information controlled. You know.
Yeah. Exactly.
To fortify. Well,
yeah, exactly. Well, you had mentioned like the concept of like the sovereign, who's actually the sovereign mm-hmm. in America, and you also mentioned Edward Bernays, and that he wrote a book called Propaganda back in I think the early 1920s, late mm-hmm. 1920s, and he actually described the like the whoever controls the media as like the hidden government essentially. And you know what? I actually just pulled up this quote. He said here in Propaganda, the conscious and intelligent manipulation of the organized habits and opinions of the masses is an important element in democratic society. Those who manipulate this unseen mechanism of society constitute an invisible government, which is the true ruling power of our country, the true sovereign, right? Mm-hmm. And he was so spot on with that. And that is ultimately who is the sovereign in this country, is the people forming our thoughts, forming our perception of reality, right? Framing the debate, deciding what can and cannot be discussed. And, you know, we see this in play with the COVID situation, with the election situation, with virtually every major political issue, right?
Yeah, Walter Lippmann said that he said that public opinion didn't really exist. It was sort of manufactured, that it was just something that was kind of confected. It didn't really
it's almost like they saw it as something to be exploited.
Yeah, right? He said it was so important that public basically the public passions or attitudes in order to govern, you had to be able to exploit and manipulate it. So, I mean
Yeah. To where I mean, you look at the way information is conveyed and it can be done in an honest, altruistic manner, sort of like the discussion that we're having. We're not trying to deceive anybody. We're just two guys, speaking what's on our mind and talking about some important topics versus a guy like Bernays or some of these other people that control the media where they clearly have an agenda and they're systematically deceiving the masses and promoting agendas that are detrimental to the nation and to the country in order to advance very specific political interests.
Yeah, I mean, you can see that because if you watch TV shows from 50, 60 years ago, like talk shows, political talk shows, they were much slower paced and more deliberative, although they were controlled, like William Buckley's firing line. He was always a controlled – he was an asset of the regime. He was there to sort of corral and control the right wing. But nevertheless, if you watch his shows, he'd have figures on like Enoch Powell or something, and he wouldn't he'd criticize them, but it wouldn't be name calling. Or you could watch in the 50s, and one of the top rated shows was a priest explaining philosophy and theology on a chalkboard. Was a very popular show. So those who control the media can provide programming and information that's edifying. And at first, they couldn't really make TV as bad as it was because they had to introduce it to people. And so it was kind of a slow introduction. So it got progressively worse as time went by in the late 60s and 70s. And by the mid 70s, it was a cesspool.
Right.
So
and it's even worse today. Yeah. It's way worse
now
today.
Media with pornography. I was reading about social media and how someone, E. Michael Jones, wrote an article about Elizabeth II and how she presided over the decline of Great Britain, the moral corruption of Great Britain. And as a sovereign, she could have stepped in and stopped it, and she didn't. That's something she has to answer for now, I presume. But you're saying how you just look up the Queen on social media, and pops up pornography everywhere, and you can't get around it now. Now, why is that the case? I mean, obviously, if there was a sovereign that had the best interest of the of the public at heart, it would stop this, because there'd be no debate about the merits of pornography, and be like, no, it's obvious that's bad, and the hell with free speech. This isn't speech. And at the same time, of course, the regime, which allows unrestricted pornography on the airwaves, is working to suppress political speech, is what it's all about. That's what the First Amendment's all about. That's in the United States. That doesn't really apply to Great Britain, but there you have it.
Right. Yeah.
It's like, why is this tolerated? Why? Okay. Now we have a situation where we're witnessing full satanic inversion, because now we have like Drag Queen Story Hour, and you have Children's Hospital, and that are cutting the breasts off young girls, castrating young boys and putting them chemically castrated, and actually in many cases actually castrating them under the guise of affirming, this is affirming surgery for supposed transgender people.
It's straight.
And they're acting outraged if you criticize them for this. They're the ones that are being victimized. So the pedophiles, the groomers, and these people who are the mutilators are the victim here, not the children and their parents.
Yeah, you're right. And I mean, I think you nailed it. I mean, it literally is like satanic inversion, like a total turning of everything on its head. And we see that there's many examples of that, like all throughout history. I mean, just the official narrative of World War II, for example, is a satanic inversion. It's like the opposite of what really happened. Same thing with 9/11 and many of these other events. I wanted to make one more point about just the role the media has played in COVID, and that is obviously suppressing information and only promoting certain narratives, pro-vaccine, mm-hmm. Pro-government, this sort of like fear-based mind control program. One of the things they're not reporting are the very serious problems that countless people around the world are experiencing after taking the vaccine. We've seen headlines and reports, largely from the alternative independent media, about all these athletes that are dropping dead, about all these just average people who are just all of a sudden dying. What do they call it now? Sudden adult death syndrome? I mean, it's ridiculous. And I mean, this is passing for like a serious explanation for like why these people are dying. It's just, some sudden death, who knows? And it has nothing to do with the vaccine they just took, a month ago. I came across a website recently, and there have been a number of these that have popped up since the vaccine rollout. And this website is called realnotrare.com. And it's a very simple, I don't want to say simple website, but like what they do is very simple. They basically just find people who have had serious complications after taking the COVID shot, and they just tell their story. They basically do a very simple Q&A with them. I think they have a podcast. I haven't listened to the podcast, but if you go on the website, you can see just all sorts of examples of just very average, probably mostly good-natured people, good-hearted people, people that were likely coerced. In many cases, you read some of the stories, and many of them say that they didn't even want to take the vaccine. They thought that they were coerced in order to, keep their job or whatever. Mm-hmm. They were pressured in other ways and stuff like that, societal pressure. They were, constantly getting these ideas from the government and the media and other authority figures. So they felt they had to take the vaccine. And it's resulted in just absolute devastation for so many people. And it's so unfair. And they're unfortunately, I don't see them getting justice.
No, because to admit that they have to admit the entire thing and the regime would collapse. It partially has already, because trust in public health or in medicine institutions is at all time low, and it's that distrust is well deserved, unfortunately.
Oh my gosh! Yeah, who is believing anything these people are saying anymore?
Vaccines have always been, I think, the benefits of vaccines have always been greatly exaggerated, and the risk greatly, you know, discounted or not underestimated as you look at the numbers. They never, you know, some of the boast of the effective inoculations of vaccines are simply just wrong, like whether it's polio or smallpox. They just simply weren't eradicated. And it wasn't inoculation that stopped it. It was just improved public health and sanitation and overall improvements in diet and these things. And if you look at the charts, this is the way it is. But since the 1970s, you've had this explosion like in autism and chronic disease across the board. So public health has been a dismal failure. It's exploded, but it's great for the business model. If you look at the sort of this, if you look at public health or medicine sort of as an extraction, process of extraction of wealth, then it's very successful because it's exploded. Right.
It's a total racket, yeah.
As an industry. It isn't to say you know, that the modern health system can step in and save your life with, you know, adroit application of antibiotics or even surgery, trauma surgery, and these things. But a lot of these are very problematic. A good example, again, and they normalize the disease. Good example how allergies or even autism has been largely normalized, meaning we don't see it as something really strange. Just the explosion, of course, corresponds with the increase in the vaccine schedule. So you have, you have a correlation there, which is basis of some suspicion of causation, I guess you could say, if you look at it. But since the people like that, I think Dr. Fauci took over the infectious disease department of NIH in the late 70s, and the rate of chronic illness has exploded since then. And this speaks to,
exactly.
The great toxicity that modern life is now with processed foods and chemical fertilizers and these things and the modern lifestyle, and also just these vaccines, which aren't, a lot of this represents heavy metal poisoning and whatever else they put in these things, mercury, aluminum, all adjuvants that screw up, play games with your immune system. And of course, the mRNA vaccine, the mRNA is a complete different thing. It's not a traditional vaccine. It's actually foreign gene therapy, which is untested,
Gene therapy, gene manipulation. Yeah. Exactly. But of course, it's never presented that way, right? I mean, it's never explained that way to people. And if it is, it's lionized as this, wonderful new scientific development or something. And the side effects are never discussed or never addressed. It's really incredible, and it's very, very depressing to read these stories and see all these people that have just had their lives totally destroyed. I mean, you read some of these stories, and they're athletes and their parents, and they're literally like bedridden, and they like can't even function normally. Mm-hmm. And it's just absolutely such an outrage. And 9 times out of 10, most of these people that are suffering from these debilitating side effects admit that they were basically coerced into even taking the vaccine to begin with. They didn't even want to take it. And that's what I hear from, personally, when I talk to people that took the vaccine, that 9 times out of 10, again, it's because they felt they had to in order to keep their job.
It definitely wasn't informed consent, which is supposedly a standard that's supposed to be before you present a drug to somebody, or informed consent. And basically they had misinformed consent because it was all the fear mongering. They never, these doctors never clearly explained to these people what the risks were, not just with the vaccine, but also the risk regarding COVID out there. If you look at the average age being 81, those who died from it, if you're under 50, you really had no reason to be fearful of it. And if, the comorbidities, most of the people dying had multiple comorbidities. So, then you have a lot of the old people dying, but of course they perhaps weren't dying really of COVID. They were dying of neglect in the old age homes. From neglect and isolation.
Yeah, exactly.
So there's that. Remember the story? Remember the stuff about talks about Donald Trump was talking about like frozen, trucks being shipped to New York to house dead bodies.
Yeah, yeah.
That never happened. Or the ship that went, the medical ship that went up there, to receive all, you know, the supposed the hospitals are being overwhelmed, and I think they treated three patients or something.
Yeah,
you know?
They set up all these yeah. like they were basically like big props in this COVID hoax.
Yeah, then yeah, those people
and this
going
COVID drama.
These hospitals aren't busy, and you know what's going on here. You know, it's like
yeah, exactly. Well, I remember back like gosh, it would have been like March or April of 2020. There's a guy on YouTube named Jason Goodman who was in New York City. Walking around live streaming in New York City, you know, running into paramedics and firefighters and, you know, and everybody's just like sitting around, like looking on their phone. Like nobody's, there's no pandemic. There's no emergency. He was going into hospitals and yeah, there's nothing going on. Yeah. And then of course that, you know, in order to sort of manufacture and perpetuate this idea that there is this huge pandemic that, you know, you mentioned the ships that were brought into, I think, New York Harbor. There was one brought into Los Angeles Harbor. And, you know, they're setting up all these mobile morgues and all these other pop-up clinics that you saw all over in pretty much any major urban area or even small towns. And then you had the testing centers and all this other nonsense. It was just absolutely ridiculous. And believe it or not, I think you actually even mentioned it, you know, just a few minutes ago. The mainstream media is actually basically at this point admitting that the COVID-19 pandemic was essentially a globalist conspiracy theory. Or sorry, not a conspiracy theory, but a globalist conspiracy. I had mentioned when I emailed you to do this podcast, I sent you a link to that Politico special report where it's like this very detailed, lengthy report.
Like 60 pages, yeah.
Yeah, going through and exposing. Here's the headline: how four private groups use their clout to control the global COVID response with little oversight.
Yeah,
and
so
they
again,
name a couple of them. Yeah, it's like
that question, who's the sovereign here, right?
Exactly. That's exactly right. And they name a couple of them. I mean, obviously the World Health Organization was instrumental in all of this, the CDC. But the private organizations, it was the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. Mm-hmm. It was Gavi, which I believe is actually heavily financed by Bill Gates, if I'm not mistaken, as well.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And there was a British-based one. Gosh, let me see if I can find the name. I can't. The other two, I actually didn't even recognize
the
names.
The Wellcome Trust.
Okay, yeah. Which, from what I understand, isn't that kind of a similar type of organization as Gavi, just based in the UK?
Yeah, yeah. It's and they work. You know, they work in conjunction with Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation.
The last one was the vaccine
alliance.
Exactly.
The vaccine alliance, and they're tied into the big pharmaceutical industries. You know.
Which yeah, then, exactly.
Owned by Vanguard and BlackRock.
Yeah. And guys, I don't know. This really didn't seem to make a lot of headlines anywhere. I found it on Hunter Wallace's excellent website, Occidental Descent, OccidentalDescent.com. I'll have a link to it when I post this podcast program and, you know, people can check it out. And I mean, it's just incredible. It's very similar to this is another article you mentioned, that Molly Ball article published by Time Magazine shortly after the 2020 election, where she just outlined how the election itself was basically manipulated and stolen from Trump by a very organized and dedicated and very coordinated group of left-wing organizations and labor unions and the media and activist groups. And they all basically collaborated to, you know, of course, steal the election, but they describe it as fortifying democracy or securing democracy or whatever they said. So it's basically, again, quote-unquote conspiracy theorists being proven right about everything, and then the mainstream media comes along and basically admits it all and outlines it in a very lengthy, detailed report.
Yeah, it was almost bragging about it, you know. Hey, we did it. And I mean,
and here's the people involved in it, and you know, these people on the internet and YouTube that have all had their channels taken down were right the entire time.
Mm-hmm. And the vaccine, I'm sorry, the pandemic served an important function because it allowed for all this mail-in voting in the states, which furnished a lot of the, you know, the 81 million votes that gave Biden the victory.
Well, and you know, see, that to me is really one of the biggest aspects of COVID. I mean, the COVID-19 pandemic really played the key role in the theft of the election from Trump. And what's incredible is that he went along with virtually every single aspect of it, even though he did criticize like the lockdowns, for example, and and other policies. But I mean, to this day, he continues to be like one of the leading cheerleaders of the vaccine.
Yeah. Was it Project? What's it called again?
Trump. It's something Trump's involved
with. Warp Speed.
Oh,
yeah.
Operation Warp Speed. Yeah.
It doesn't really.
And that was a big boondoggle for the big pharma companies. I mean, trillions of dollars, probably.
Yeah. And basically, they get a direct access to the U.S. Treasury and the Fed.
They have a blanket check to develop these totally unnecessary and dangerous vaccines. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That's what happened. And Trump was behind it all, sadly.
Yeah, he got – and same thing also with sort of the 2020 riots there to sort of create that disruption, which throughout the various states, and he wasn't able to – either was unwilling or unable to put them down. But this created this nonsense where supposedly we're in a pandemic and we have to stay 6 feet apart. We can't go to church. We can't see grandmother in the hospital or in a retirement home. You can't have a wedding, but tens of thousands of people can be pressed cheek to jowl for just protesting justice, supposedly for the George Floyd death. But that was okay, and you had health officials say it wasn't a concern. Well, because racism is a bigger public health concern than COVID. I was like, what? What are you talking about? It's like, you're speaking in poetry now. What are you talking about? Your public health officials, your opinion on sociological questions like racism, really have no value. But nevertheless, they actually made that argument.
You know? Oh yeah,
Couple of weeks, COVID went away. Remember during the George Floyd riots?
Yeah, exactly.
And then it came back again. You know, it's
Yeah, no, they were out there. Let's see, it was 1,200 signatures from public health experts, quote unquote, basically saying that, we have to let these terrorists take over our cities because racism is a greater public health threat than this COVID pandemic.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, it was looking back on it, I mean, it was only 2 years ago. It's just so incredible what happened that year.
Yeah, just sort of this a nationwide struggle session, completely created by the media and also by the Democratic Party, which urged them on. Kamala Harris encouraging the riot. Then they turn around and they lower the boom on the January 6th protesters. All of a sudden, law and order is a big concern of theirs. And how dare people riot and question the legitimacy of an election? You know, who dares question an election? Although you have, Joe Biden himself during the campaign agreeing with statements that Trump wasn't a legitimate campaign elected president. You have Kamala Harris talking about election fraud. I mean, for 20 years, Democrats have been talking about election fraud, whether it's 2000, 2004 in Ohio, in 2016 in Donald Trump, Russia apparently changing the election by buying ads on Facebook or something. And
it's like every time they lose, the election was stolen and there's election irregularities and outright fraud. And then when they win, it's the most secure election in history.
Yes.
Which is the narrative that they ran with 2020, which was probably the greatest inversion I've ever seen in my life. I mean,
it was the most insecure election in U.S. history. Because
it was, insecure and just not even plausible. Like the idea that Biden received the most votes in any election in history – when the guy literally couldn't even get 10 people to a rally. I mean, it was just so absurd.
And supporting, supporting Stop the Steal or questioning the election, these things now becomes basis for the Justice Department to hound and harass you and get subpoenas and steal your phone.
Exactly,
All that's legal, by the way. Even like they're even trying to suggest that somehow setting up or planning to have alternative electors is somehow – illegal, although that's perfectly legal. It's in the process, especially at the state level, because the states are given plenary authority to decide. The state legislature's plenary authority to decide the manner in which electors are chosen, so they can any time come in and send their own electors, and the federal government has no say in it whatsoever. They're now pretending as if this is something that's unheard of, despite the fact that in several elections, previous elections, Democrats have come out and called for alternative electors. I think it was Raskin from Maryland suggested people should do this to deny Trump his his presence in 2016.
Raskin, he's that Mormon guy or what? Oh no, he's Jewish. Yeah, he's the Jewish guy. Yeah,
you know, the guy who thinks that riots are the worst thing ever. But then if they have him on C-SPAN in 1992, when he was a law professor at American University, saying we shouldn't be too harsh on the rioters in LA because this was a justice protest.
Yeah, these people are such hypocrites. Well, I mean, you're so right. And I mean, Biden's. We described it as the red rant speech in American Free Press.
Yes.
I mean, it was really this very bizarre, very dark and like angry and like just a very disturbing speech. So hypocritical where, I mean, as you mentioned, you know, Biden's basically denouncing political violence and anybody who questions the integrity of America's elections. Yet, I mean, you know, of course, he and his party openly embrace and supported BLM and Antifa terrorists and continue to this very day. Especially during the 2020, I'd describe it as the American color revolution, basically. That's what it was. And, of course, these are the same people that promoted the truly ludicrous conspiracy theory that Russia hacked our elections to get Trump elected in 2016. I mean, talk about questioning the integrity.
Yeah, they actually brought in the FBI.
Yeah.
To do this, that's working with the Clinton campaign. This is a crime, which again, for which there's no investigation. We just know what happened now, and the proven people who committed perjury, like James Brennan, are given positions on MSNBC. They're unmolested, but you know, you have all these Trump aides being harassed and hounded, being arrested, being charged. It's all, you know, it's such obviously it's not what we call it a double standard, because that would say that somehow the Trump's advisors were equally guilty, but you had this whole trumped up Russia thing, which is now has been exposed. That's not an insurrection. That's not treason or something, but
yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean, the double standards and the hypocrisy are just, it's so insulting and just in your face. It's incredible.
Well, I think a lot of people don't realize is you're dealing with a revolutionary, you're dealing with, Czechists and Commissars, people like Merrick Garland or Alejandro Mayorkas, their own loyalties are to their particular tribe and that ideology that they profess. They don't have really ever – they're not constitutional officers, and they can't be shamed into doing their duty or following the law. So they're going to do what they're going to get away with. That's why you had this spectacle last year, which actually turned Virginia red, back to red from blue, when he threatened to go after parents who were protesting – or speaking up at school board meetings. School meetings are for, by the way. It's in a forum for the public.
Yeah, you go and participate in your local like city council or school board hearing. Yeah. And you're a terrorist.
He labels his Justice Department threatens to label them domestic terrorists or counter revolutionaries, which is typical of a Czechist, because a Czechist defines a counter revolutionary as someone who simply doesn't want to go along with a particular agenda, and his agenda is revolution. And you know, then it comes out that his family is making money off critical race theory programs. They provide curriculum material for these things that are throughout the country. They're making millions off this stuff, which is ultimately paid for by the taxpayers. So the Garland family is getting rich off programs that are there to demoralize, defame, and smear the dwindling white majority of the country. You know.
That's what it is. Yeah. I mean, that's the only way to look at it. I mean, this is an outright war on white America. And it's been going on for a very long time. But now it's reaching a point where it's just like, again, like just so in your face. And it sort of smacks of, to me anyways, I want to get your take. It smacks of like desperation. I mean, you look at like Biden's speech in Philadelphia and just the rhetoric in general from the Biden administration. They recently hosted a summit on white supremacy. I don't know if you saw that.
Yeah, United We Stand.
It was called United We Stand, exactly.
Yeah.
Now, they proceed to
smear more than half the country.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, this was just last week. I think it was last Thursday that they had that they held this summit. And this is a summit that was basically organized by the ADL.
Yes.
Right? And I mean, they had this summit. They had hearings in Congress about the threat of white supremacy. I mean, they always do, but even last week they had more hearings about it. So it's just it's this narrative that they continue to perpetuate despite the obvious reality that white people continue to be victimized in the most outrageous, unacceptable ways by career degenerate like reprobate, just total black criminal thugs that should not even be on the streets to begin with. And there's so many examples. It's like every single day I see another headline or another story about some innocent white person, or not even necessarily, they're not always even white. They're just like innocent people being victimized by these criminals that should have never even been on the streets to begin with. And I guess what I'm getting at is all of this rhetoric we see from Biden and his administration, it seems they're just so desperate, and it's like they recognize that their control over the narrative, their like the military and economic dominance, this like this unipolar world order, is just rapidly being eroded. You saw the UN and the World Jewish Congress, and I think it was the European Commission, all just collaborated recently to launch a social media campaign about basically demonizing the spread of quote-unquote conspiracy theories about COVID and Israel. And they even specifically mentioned the Rothschilds and George Soros. I mean, all of this, it's like this entire globalist system, and the Biden administration obviously is merely a puppet of this broader system, they just seem so desperate anymore. You know, it's like the rhetoric we see, the narratives that they promote, their talking points, it just, to me, it just smacks of desperation.
So so George Soros and his Open Society Foundation and myriad other organizations are tied to that, are not involved in like activism and social change and undermining.
George Soros literally wrote an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal about a month ago talking about his strategy for electing left-wing, soft-on-crime prosecutors.
Yes. Yeah,
so, and if you even bring that up or cite that or point out the fact that he has a history of doing this sort of stuff, and the fact that he's Jewish, and the fact that he's this basically a Bolshevik, it's so silly. It's like this guy writes an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal outlining his agenda, and you can't even mention it because it's a anti-Semitic conspiracy theory.
So he didn't give $33 million to Black Lives Matter back in 2014?
Yeah, it's like, yeah, facts like just mean nothing to these people.
Mm-hmm. And you know, the Attorney General of Minnesota doesn't support Antifa. And he has a picture of him with a book praising his son as a member of it. Of course, Antifa doesn't really exist.
It's an idea, yeah. Meanwhile, they portray white supremacy as this like monolithic, very organized.
So the UN's talking
threat
about.
Or something, yeah.
What are you talking about? The UN's – you got the director of the UN talking about white supremacy. Okay, what organization are you talking about?
Who knows? They don't even know. The only ones that they will actually specifically mention are these like manufactured groups like the base or what are the other ones?
They'll follow – a good example is this United We Stand conference at the White House hosted, which is an anti-hating whitey program, and you have these experts, and they say, well, hate crimes are up this much, and there's this much, and according to the ADL,
that's who they're citing.
Is the ADL a disinterested party? What is the ADL? Do we have another organization that isn't used to launder Jewish mobster money and, the names of Jewish mobsters and there to stir up hate against, against the white Christians? You might want to cite another organization, but the ADL fronts itself as anti-defamation when their business is defamation. I mean, this is satanic inversion that we're dealing with.
Right. Know? Exactly.
Just like how he talks
about, kills me.
The rule of law. We have to. The MAGA Americans are against the rule of law. What are you talking about? You just spent 2020. You all cheered all the rioting. these are justice protests.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, I think that to me the most insulting aspect of it all is that while Biden and his team and the media and everybody else is continually hyping the threat of white supremacy and domestic extremism and all this other nonsense, we see very vivid examples of just shocking violence, criminality, and just mayhem plaguing every big city in the country, even small towns. I'm sure. Did you read about that the case in Memphis, the Eliza Fletcher?
Yeah, the jogger. Yeah,
jogging 4:30 in the morning out by herself, and she's abducted and raped. I believe raped. I don't know if they've actually brought rape charges, but the gentleman. What am I saying? The total animal that did this to her has. I mean, this guy should have never been on the streets to begin with.
No, he raped somebody. He's been a problem since age 11.
He had been in jail most of his life and then was let out. He committed a rape in, I think it was like September 2021, that they are only just now like finding out about and prosecuting. And then he abducted this woman and murdered her. I mean, it's just this sort of stuff is just so outrageous. Yeah,
the Biden administration is still talking about Emmett Till 67 years ago.
Yeah, exactly.
You know.
Really, I guess what I'm getting at is that this is obviously sort of like a left wing thing, but it's facilitated by Democrats and Republicans, frankly, because no one will bring this up, no one will put it this way, no one will say that what is going on is just a blatant assault on white America, and even Republicans have been champions of criminal justice reform. And these other like soft on crime approaches to law enforcement and all this other social justice and racial justice nonsense. I mean, you know, and we just make one excuse after the next for these just degenerate criminals dominating our streets. I mean, when is enough going to be enough with this?
Yeah, it's almost like I advocate criminal justice reform, and my policies have released more feral Negroes onto the streets than Democrats.
Yeah, that's the way I know. So, it's like,
you know, and there are feral. I'm sorry, but the system has produced them. And again, this is the legacy of pretty much the civil rights agenda.
Yes, absolutely.
Where it's basically gets white guilt and black, victimization, and the regime likes that. And not surprising that, you know, a character like Merrick Garland isn't too concerned about the black crime wave. But he's too busy telling people that the Justice Department is there to protect blacks from whites, even though if I look at the crime statistics, I think it's 11 to 1 or something. Black.
Yeah. Crime, right? Well, and think about it. I mean, you know, the 2020 color revolution was largely instigated by a career criminal drug dealer, a drug addict, who basically killed himself because he took too many drugs. It didn't really have anything to do with the police officer.
That's the inversion I'm talking about.
Yeah. This Memphis woman doesn't even get a mention by anybody. You know, and this is common. I mean, this is very typical, like with these very gruesome murders, like nobody even knows about this. Nobody will even mention it. The president is certainly not going to talk about it.
Or like Trump. Waukesha, last November.
Yeah, right? Yeah, exactly.
You got Daryl Brooks drives over a bunch of.
And that was clearly, I mean, I think it's been pretty well established by the guys at the National Justice Party that was very much racially motivated. Mm-hmm. And that is not even mentioned anywhere.
Well, the whole summer of 2020 and George Floyd was unleashing of black terror.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that's what it is. Blacks are used as proxies or as to go in to create mayhem. They've kind of become a lumpen proletariat, at least a large cohort of them that can be unleashed and do this. And basically, if law enforcement stands down, you have a lot of crime. And either way, the politicians can navigate the politics of it, exploit crime to get elected or create crime to get elected. Right. That's the thing. That's something we've seen since the 1960s.
Right.
Street crime is a governing strategy. It's anarcho tyranny. You can get away with a lot if people are worried about street crime. That's one element to it. And that's what you're seeing now. And the politics may change, and the politicians will pivot perhaps to benefit from it. You remember, you're probably too young to remember. I remember the 70s with sort of the reaction to the excesses of the 60s. And there was people thought that poverty created crime, adversity did. The only problem was crime rates were exploding when material conditions were improving. So there's something else going on here. And of course, you had the collapse of the black family in the 1960s, the rise of white guilt and the collapse of white authority, which with that went to standards, middle class standards, which made society possible and nice. And so you could be rude and loud and behave in all sorts of ways because you were oppressed, damn it. And this created streets that were simply unlivable. Same time the Black Panthers were militarized, FBI were involved in this, and they shut them down. So there's a lot of deep state operations going on, and a lot of COINTELPRO crap going on there. And it's hard to make a left-right distinction here because it's being manipulated. By the state.
Well, and both political parties, certainly both mainstream political parties.
Yeah,
are totally involved in this.
Yeah, black crime is used to empty the urban neighborhoods, the ethnic, particularly the Catholic ones, to drive them into suburbia, where they can be subjected to all types of psychological warfare to become sort of sex robots and debt-ridden consumers, which can now are just white guys who have no standing because, what do you have to? I'm white. Well, white doesn't really, right? It's not really an ethnic group. It's just it's skin pigmentation. And that's what they've deracinated everybody. There's an attempt now to sort of create a white identity, which may be forged in all this. There is an American identity that should be defended, I think, separate, as problematic as it is. But definitely they've stirred up the past couple of years. They stirred up the crime for some reason. And again, it's all maybe part of a, kind of a real estate scheme or something. You can do that too. You can destroy a property values for a couple decades and come in and gentrify it or something, or something even, something more sinister, perhaps like a Great Reset or something, or maybe just they're losing control.
Yeah. I think it's probably a little bit of everything you just mentioned, but I mean, these totally misguided and like malicious policies where, these criminals are just basically treated with kids' gloves.
The Safety Act in Illinois with Pritzker.
Yeah, exactly.
What are you doing?
Yeah, like these what should be like actual felonies are like not even being pursued anymore. Mm-hmm. And you see this not only there in Illinois, but you see in parts of California and parts of New York. I mean, in all pretty much any big city, you see these sorts of policies. So I mean, this very soft on crime approach.
Can't encourage. In order to have a society that functions, you have to – in order to have the civil liberties and the Bill of Rights and the rights that we presume to have, you have to – the people themselves have to be self-governing, have to not to be slave to their passions, and have to have an internal constitution which governs them. Like Edmund Burke would write about this. A man is predisposed to liberty to the extent that he can control himself, and this is true. And so you have in this society, particularly in the black community, you're very unruly, passionate. They're a slave to their passions. They're the most sexually liberated among us. There's just the spade kicks that the beatniks wrote about, that on the road. And then there was the white Negro with that was written about in the 60s era. We envied the freedom of the Negro, particularly in sexual matters. But the problem is there's consequences to this behavior. And part of that is sort of criminal behavior, sort of this pathological feral behavior, because there's no guidance or anything. And so if society is liberated from these restrictions, internal restrictions and controls, if you have internal chaos, you're not going to have public order. You're going to have public chaos. And everything in the past 60 years has been encouraging internal chaos with the sexual revolution and the sort of liberalism itself. Hey, you do what you want to do. Just do it, with homosexuality and this transgenderism. This unleashes this creates public disorder or chaos because people themselves are internally chaotic.
Yeah.
And so you have an authoritarian regime to control law. Like New York relies on authoritarian measures, at least it did, to control the crime problem. That's what stop and frisk was. That's what was anti-loitering policies, or the broken window policy that was instituted, which actually really stopped the crime. And also there was mass incarceration of black criminals. That's really – so when they started decarcerating, the crime started shooting up again. That's what we've had the past few years,
Yeah, well, that's what happens when there's no standards anymore. There's this mm-hmm. very libertine type mindset, and just excuse after excuse for, I mean, it's not really excuses applied to white people. I mean, it's frankly minorities. I mean, they commit a crime and there's an excuse for whatever they do. There's no consequences for actions anymore, for crimes especially, and we see this especially in the inner cities. I mean, it's just outrageous.
Well,
that has to change.
We're used to the Kill a Mockingbird narrative, and by the way, it's just a book or a movie, where there's the humble, noble Negro innocent who was set upon by a horny white chick.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
That's the story, right?
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
What's the okay, that could happen in some instances. I'm willing, and from the standpoint of that particular story and movie, it's a great movie, well written. I mean, Horton Foote did the screenplay. He was a great writer. He did great these movies about common people. It was a very good movie, and it's a very moving movie. But that's not why it was produced.
Yeah,
there,
right.
To create a narrative.
Narrative and agenda.
The reality is that quite often throughout the South and throughout the country, particularly in the urban areas when the Great Migration North is, you had a lot of blacks from the Delta, Mississippi Delta, coming north, or from the rural areas going into the city, the anonymity of the city, and they're relatively free, and their passions are unleashed. It becomes chaotic. You have crime. A lot of young males, and same thing in the South. If they didn't have restrictions, you'd have a lot of problems with the crime. This is something like the aftermath of the Civil War, the breakdown of law and order, and you had a lot of raping and pillaging by blacks, and there was a reaction to it. And that's why you had the original iteration or formation of the Ku Klux Klan, was to bring order, the Night Riders and all that. And this is why you had frontier justice and the lynchings. I think 30 to 40% of lynchings occurred to white people, and it was a form of frontier justice. But we have the narrative of To Kill a Mockingbird, and this kind of forms our opinion of these things. But it's just a narrative. The other side of that is you have a lot of raping and killing, and if there aren't repercussions or consequences for that action, for those actions, you can get a lot more of it, and you're going to continue to see a lot of it until there's a payback, unfortunately. And that's what happens when you have a breakdown of law and order. If the police aren't there to protect you, someone's going to have to step in and protect people. So they're inviting this. They're inviting, street justice and a death wish type scenario.
Yeah. Well, but I mean, even then, if you do actually defend yourself, you're going to be prosecuted and.
Yes, we saw it with the McMichaels in Georgia. Yes.
The McMichaels, or there's many cases. That couple down in St. Louis.
Yes.
I mean, there's many, many, many examples. The McMichaels is, wow, that was so outrageous, such an injustice. The details of that case, I mean, my goodness. Yeah, no, you're right. I mean, I completely agree with you. I think you're making a lot of good points. And you know what? We're going to have to go ahead and wrap up. I told you I'd keep you here about an hour and a half. And
okay.
I'm going to have to let you go. But I appreciate it. Thank you very much for taking the time. It's been a great conversation, as I knew it would be. And definitely keep up the good work, and we'll stay in touch, and we'll do this again in the future.
Thank you. Take care out there.
Okay. Thanks, Tim. We'll talk to
you
later.
Good night,
then. Okay. Bye-bye. Good night.